This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Try to put on the show.
It is Danny and Gallant, and we interrupt Astro Apology Analysis to get under center with Blue 42. Brock, you are joining us now.
Here we go.
This is Coors Light's Blue 42.
We're going to go red, right, tight, close, sprint left, G, U corner, half back, flat, on two. Ready?
Right. Blue 42 is brought to you by Coors Light. The mountains turn blue at 42 degrees.
Blue 42!
Now here's your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Blue 42! Blue 42!
Morning, Brock. How are you now?
Good morning, man. I'm doing well. We're about 48 hours away from Seattle Dragon, XFL game number two. CenturyLink going to be alive, going to be rocking. I'm really worried about my hairdo, Paul, come Saturday if the rain and wind come.
Oh, no.
I'm going to figure all that stuff out.
You going to wear a hat?
Probably, right? Probably got to go hat.
Beanie?
Rocking cap. You go, you know, just kind of baseball cap. There's just... there's a lot of considerations when you're down there on the sideline.
Cowboy hat. How about that?
Probably not.
You can pull it off. Anyway, Brock, what's going to be the biggest priority this season, this offseason, for last year's Seahawks draft class?
Yeah, you know, I was listening to Wyman on the afternoon show this week, obviously with Bob and Jim, and, you know, he's talking about these rookies, and Dave always gives so much grace to rookies because he looks back at his rookie year, much like I do mine, and thinks about my peer group and the rookie class that I had way back when in 1999, and how few of them adjusted very well to being rookies in the NFL. And Dave is very optimistic, as I am, that this rookie class is going to take a significant jump from their freshman to their sophomore year. College coaches say, and we'll tell you all the time, and the numbers show it, that the biggest jump you make in your college career is from year one to year two. And when it comes to professional football, and I think especially for these drafted guys, and especially those that got a little taste of it, like Cody Barton, like L.J. Collier, like Ben Burkervin, you know, like Murkervin that got a little taste of it, I do expect a significant jump this offseason. There's no more class to go to. You now have some coin in your pocket so you can pay trainers. This was the offseason that we all watched Chris Carson totally change his body when he came back to minicamps year number two, and we went, my gosh, this is a different guy. This was the offseason that Jermaine Defetti slimmed down. His feet looked a whole lot better than they did his rookie year. And I'm fascinated to see what L.J. Collier is going to do. And is he going to make a decision to get a little bit lighter and try to add a little more twitch and quickness? Is he going to make the decision that he's going to add more grown man strength and get even bigger if he's going to play at this level? Cody Barton is a guy that did some really nice things. I think he's got most of the tools there, but I do think he needs to add some thump. I'd like to see him come back 5 to 10 pounds heavier if he can do that in this offseason. So I think for each guy, it's a bit case-dependent, but this is going to be a big off-season. And when we're all out there in April watching, or May, watching their first, you know, rookie mini camp, I'm anxious to see what this rookie class has done to continue to transform themselves, because there's some pretty good raw tools there available.
It will be – we'll see how good – I think these past two draft classes have been pretty good, but sort of the proof is going to be in the pudding as it lays out over the next couple seasons. They've got an opportunity, though. They've got three picks in the first two rounds. I expect that to translate into about five players. Brock, what do you think their approach is going to be with those picks?
Yeah, that's generally kind of how they do it, Danny. But this one's unique. You know, John Schneider, when he's going to join you guys, you know, as he does, with his wife, Tracy, before the draft and all the work that they do. And he gives, you know, a pretty good download before the draft of where that board is and what he likes and doesn't like. You'll often talk about kind of these big ledges, these big cliffs where there's a grouping of talent and then there's just this big cliff where, you know, it kind of falls down. And whether it's like three first-round X guys at this position and then all of a sudden there's a pretty good ledge until the third round where you get the next big clumping of it. And they love to kind of group players that way, which is so often why they do trade back, because that grouping of players is gone and then that next grouping is going to be available in their mind 15 or 20 or 30 picks later. But this year is a little unique, Danny, in that the wide receiver class is so stinking talented. So I don't know if that means they're going to draft a wide receiver, but it means that some teams that could be looking for it with an elite guy still on the board is there. And you're right. Maybe you had a bunch of different invaluable picks, and it's not just, oh, here's an additional third, you know, but maybe it's the following year's first-round pick or second-round pick. So this is going to be a unique year, I think, with a lot of opportunity because there are some deep, deep spots of personnel with teams around the league, in particular, looking for those game changers at wide receiver.
Question two. Three Pac-12 coaches have left for greener pastures, all while under contract. Mel Tucker, he's going to take double what Colorado was paying him. What's going on in the Pac-12, Brock?
Yeah, Danny, this was the worst of all of them because I think Chris Peterson just left for, you know, the freedom of being kind of unlocked from college football. I don't think it was he was looking for more money or more power or more prestige or anything else. So that one was a little bit unique. There's no question that Mike Leach looked for a bigger payday, and he got it in a bigger conference that's got a wealth of resources in the SEC. And then this is the one I think that really stings at the conference level. This is the one that got me a bit emotional and tweeting about it. And that was lost to Mel Tucker to Michigan State. And a guy that had a 5-7 record, who had 5 career wins as a head coach on his ledger. Albeit he waited a long, long time for a head coaching job. But this is the one that absolutely stings. And it's not just Larry Scott. I really hope this resonates at the presidential level because I believe that they're the ones that have to be held accountable for this. It is very easy to point at the commissioner, but let's remember he is employed and he has been hired by those presidents. And it is those presidents that have to look at the numbers, that have to look at the gap that is widening between their conference, the Big Ten conference, and the SEC conference. Because the Big Ten just doubled the pay of Mel Tucker. I think one of the rising coaches, one of the coaches that the folks in Colorado love, that felt like they finally got the right guy after a bunch of different tries, and ultimately Michigan State said, yeah, thanks, you fans in Boulder and the Pac-12, but we'll pay him double. We'll pay his coaches double. We'll give him every resource available. So it's not a lateral move whatsoever. He's going to get every opportunity to compete. And if you're a coach in the Pac-12 competing against the Big Ten and SEC, you're watching that playing field get more and more unlevel every day.
So this is about
Brock, his recruiting budget. Does his recruiting budget stay as big? Is that the right word for it? I don't know. They've had some suspicious recruiting victories here. Does that migrate with him to Michigan State?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, it probably does. You know, his methodology is a little more SEC-esque in his background at Alabama and Georgia. So, yes, I think it probably does.
His methodology is a little more SEC-esque.
You like that?
I do.
I did a podcast yesterday with John Wilner at the San Jose Mercury News, and we talked about maybe a couple schools in this conference that have a methodology SEC-esque, and we finished
cheating.
The same thing.
He's like, cheating.
You handled that
cheating.
Yeah, in a very Houston Astros kind of way. That was unique.
May as well just call him the Houston Astros at that point. Question three. All right, so you're going to be there for XFL Week 2. What's your biggest fear for the XFL this coming week and beyond?
Paul, I got a chance to jump on the radio last night with Lydia on her wonderful show doing the XFL and the Seattle Dragons, and Lydia's going to be a star on the sidelines as well come Saturday, and I told Lydia yesterday what I'm going to tell you right now. My biggest fear is injury. And Danny knows this. I'm a son of a coach. I hate injuries. I hate missed practice time. But I have real fear for the quarterbacks in this league more than anybody else. That was part of the struggle of the AAF last year is you love the hard hitting. You love the contact. But, man, was it difficult to watch a lot of backups quarterbacks playing as that year evolved. And as we look at it and we sit here right now on Thursday morning, I doubt that Aaron Murray is going to play. He got a foot injury. He's a Tampa quarterback. He's kind of the name down there. He played at Plant High School down in Tampa. You know, obviously very prodigious in the SEC. He is out more than likely for this game, so you're already going to have one backup. And then Brandon Silvers, quarterback here in Seattle, has not practiced all week with an ankle injury that must have occurred late in that game on Saturday in D.C. So that is my overriding concern. These rosters are small. They're 52. on game day to cut down to 46. There's not an abundance of available quarterbacks out there, and especially those that have practiced with these teams. So the injury bug at that position more than anything else is my biggest concern.
That is Blue 42 with Brock. It is brought to us Monday, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. Brock's visit brought to us by Toyota of Puyallup.
Brock Heward.
Brock, I think that there is... Yeah, I liked that drop. I know an issue near and dear to your heart involves seat reclining. Have you seen the video that's making the rounds on Twitter?
Oh, no. Oh, no. What happened?
A lady is sitting in the second to last row. She reclines her seat. The individual behind her, whose seat does not recline because he's in the last row, a.k.a. toilet class, is enraged by the reclining. According to the passenger, she punches her seat hard several times. She then begins filming, at which point he is using his fist. He's not hitting it anymore, but more like operating it in a jackhammer-like
motion.
Looks
like he's hitting a speed bag.
Yeah, just kind of like pop, 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 pop. And it just continues on, and he's like leaning forward and saying stuff. He doesn't like the reclining, and it's the question that's dividing the internet of who's wrong.
Oh, who's wrong?
Who's in the wrong?
Homeboy in the toilet seat. That's what you get.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the consequences of your decision making. Gosh, you're not a victim. You bought the toilet bowl seat. If you didn't know it, you learned that lesson after this flight to not buy that seat that doesn't recline and sit in the back of the plane. So I'm sorry, buddy. That one's on you. You got to own it.
Now, that's a very good answer, Brock. But I also know enough about you to know that you work with someone who is indignant about his right to lean back his seat and doesn't understand why anyone. And I know that you, despite your height, don't lean back your seat. So it's not necessarily that cut. Airline etiquette is a tricky thing in this case.
Oh, it is. It is. I'll tell you what's even worse is don't you dare cut in front of me when that plane lands and think you're better than anybody else. There is an etiquette and there is an order to deplaning. If the plane is late and you've got to catch a flight, understood. Maybe you can ask a few people before you cut. But, man, and I'll put an old Puyallup High School block out. You know, I'll use my hips, and I'll block people out to try to cut in front of me after
that
plane lands, because there is an order, and that etiquette is as important to me as anything.
That's more important. The other one's debatable. The early exiter, and in fact, my wife has quoted Dave Wyman in going, like, she'll look if someone tries to do that and go, why would you go?
Yeah. Don't do that. Don't go that way. Are you guys going to be watching Saturday? What do we think?
Yeah, we'll be there.
Of course. If somebody jumps over someone, I want to see your reaction. Meep, meep, meep,
meep, meep, meep. That's actually what I'm going to be reporting on the sideline, is I'm just going to be reporting on Brock's reactions. So
Brock,
expect some of those videos.
Brock, we love you, man. Thank you so much for joining us.
You got it. Have a great day, guys.
How do you feel about the leaning back?
I paid for the seat. Guess what? Planes are miserable. Just because you won the genetic lottery, I'm supposed to feel bad for you being behind me? I don't. You're taller than me. Life is unfortunate. Life is unfair.
If someone says to you, hey, could you do me a favor and not recline?
Would you
unrecline?
That. Yes, okay. I would unrecline if I. And you know what? Here's the other thing, too. Because, like, Ray Roberts basically said, oh, if you're sitting in front of me, man, well, I'm going to make it difficult for you. And I was like, oh, okay, that's a little childish. But also, if I see someone who's 6'6" behind me, I would feel bad. In my conscience, I would actually feel guilty if someone was massive behind me. But if it's someone that's about my height, or maybe only an inch taller or so, listen, I want to sleep on the plane. I am actually good at falling asleep, and I'm not going to fall asleep when I am sitting basically at like a reverse incline with how they have these seats set up in planes. You know what? You can blame the person in front of you. What you should blame is the airline, because all these airlines, they're trying to find ways to fit as many people as they possibly can. Have you seen some of those planes that they're designing in like Scotland and England, where basically you're not even sitting? You're basically like doing a wall sit for the entire flight. Now, you might have great abs at the end of that flight after 6 hours of sitting against it, but I think that to act entitled about someone in front of you who paid probably around $300 for a round-trip ticket sitting in front of you and leaning back at a very small incremental incline, which only really takes up space where your tray table is, not really where your knees are, that to me is just the worst. And it's, I feel like millennials get a bad rap for being entitled. I think the people that are pissed about people that are leaning back in front of them, they are the worst. They are the most entitled people on the planet.
Lydia, your thoughts on the lean back, don't lean back controversy when it comes to airline seats?
I don't lean back, but I'm also a tall person, and I understand being cramped on long flights especially. I don't judge when people lean back.
That's the most Lydia response ever. She's not going to inconvenience someone else, but if that person is insistent upon leaning back, she's not going to say that they're wrong either.
I'll figure
it
out.
But she personally wouldn't do it.
Lydia for office, because that is the good answer. My answer is polarizing.
Yeah, you know what? That's the kind of person we want leading everyone.
Yes.
Is somebody who's going to take all feelings into account.
I really like Mina Kimes' take, though, that you can do it on flights like over 5 hours, and within, you know, business hours, don't do it. But if it's an evening red-eye flight where you probably are sleeping, go for it. I like that.
Jess, your thoughts on lean back?
As a frequent traveler, I don't lean back because I don't find those 3.5 inches to do much for my ability to sleep on a plane. I don't mind when people lean back in front of me, except actually this just happened to me recently. Just do it gently. This guy spilled my water all over me by slamming his seat back, and I don't mind if you sleep, but please, you spilled my water, sir. Now I'm wet and sitting here. The guy sitting, like Brock said, in the toilet seat was completely in the wrong. I can't believe that.
Angry.
Well,
so angry.
Also, you're really going to sit there and do that the whole entire flight?
So angry. Just, it seems exhausting.
That's someone with issues beyond just that, and probably should have been removed from the flight because he seriously has some problems.
Now, I will say that the one thing that I have seen was Ray Roberts, who was scheduled to be in a middle seat, coming back. I think we were coming back from Charlotte. It was after a playoff game.
Oh, boy.
And he said to the guy sitting in the aisle, can we trade seats? And the guy's like, no, I kind of like my aisle. And Ray goes, I'm going to give you $100 to trade seats, man. It's going to be better for both of us. And basically then handed the guy a $100 bill and took the aisle seat. It was the most gangster move that I've ever seen.
Take control.
And also, honestly, he was probably right that it was more comfortable for everybody. It is Danny and Gallant. We're going to get away from topics of frequent commuting and flying back to apologies and whether or not the Houston Astros, whether or not, well, should Jim Crane have been punished? The Astros owner was available at a press conference this morning that has gone thoroughly disastrously. Should he have been punished?
Well, clearly the report states that I didn't know about it. Had I known about it, I certainly would have done something about it. I did hire Jeff, and I think Jeff did a lot of great things for the organization over the years. I don't think I should be held accountable. I'm here to correct it, and I'm here to take this team forward with Dusty and James. And as I said, it won't happen again on my watch.
Should the owner be punished?
I think he punished himself. I mean, he just sat in front of the media who was trying to just basically pounce at every single slip-up he had, and there were many slip-ups over the course of
this
press
much.
Conference.
He did take it started when he said that he didn't think it had it, he just said it basically wasn't that big a deal.
Listen, the Yankees have had a few comments out there. Our opinion is that this didn't impact the game. We had a good team. We won the World Series, and we'll leave it at that.
Yeah, that's not going to go over real well. 55 seconds later.
Jim, when talking about the Yankees there, did you say you feel like this didn't impact the game? And what do you mean by that?
I didn't say it didn't impact the game. Basically, as the commissioner said in his report, he's not going to go backwards. It's hard to determine how it impacted the game, if it impacted the game, and that's where we're going to leave it.
It's painful to say it didn't impact the game and then say a little bit later, I didn't say that. We're trying to figure out how it impacted the game. It's pretty obvious how it impacted the game. If the batters knew what pitch was coming, they had a better chance of hitting it. Period. End of story, Jim. This is not rocket science.
Yeah, I think he should be punished. I think that it's not just this problem, but they've had cultural problems for several years now. If you're talking about what happened to the women reporters that were in their clubhouse, he is the leadership. He's at the top of it. He still took really no responsibility for that. And even everything that played out with Roberto Osuna, the response by the club after that. I think that they have deep cultural problems there, and he's always the common denominator.
How do you punish an owner, though? It's a tricky
thing
to do.
It's really difficult, and nobody else, no other owner is going to give you support on that.
Right. That's true, too.
If it's the NBA, you just eventually, you yank the franchise from him once he becomes an embarrassment. The owner can get sued for racial discrimination in housing, like actual things that are affecting real people in their real lives, but and you don't do anything to his
still,
franchise.
Like, did the Sterlings ever really, I don't know, like, did, like, Shelley made out pretty well. She still got, like, court seats. She got all the money from that sale. She got, like, everything she wanted out of that.
It took him, it took Donald Sterling saying something that was offensive to his girlfriend that became public to embarrass him, to for them to affect the way he ran his team. And NFL, and this is where it is, the commissioner in today's leagues, he's essentially a puppet. Like, it's a stuffed shirt that's there. They're there to try and smooth over and try to present a public face. They don't have real power about the good of the game anymore.
Right. And Lydia, you made a great point. Like, the value of the team went up.
$2 billion.
When Steve Ballmer bought the team, the Clippers are one of, and look, they're in Los Angeles, so I suppose there's some value there. But historically, one of the worst franchises in the NBA. Like, they have always been a second-rate franchise in Los Angeles. No one cares about them. There's not much fan support for them. And basically, it's like, all right, you've done a poor job with your team, just like you've done a poor job with the slums that you basically own. And here you go. Here are $2.4 billion, or whatever the asking price was. What a punishment.
I don't know if it's in America, though, you can just take it from me. Like, you get nothing, and you'll like it. That would have been pretty funny to see if they could pull out.
In Soviet Russia, you could do that.
The way Jim Crane's press conference ended probably underscored the entire inanity of this session today. We'll talk more about that, and you'll also get to hear how he was, in a sense, put out of his misery during the press conference. That's next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
To summarize the Astros press conference this morning, Jim Crane, flanked by Dusty Baker, who wasn't even employed by the team when it happened, and two players who simply read statements of apology. Alex Bregman was solemn. Jose Altuve did sound, I would say he sound chastened.
Like, yes.
He definitely sound down. And Jim Crane, who said it didn't affect competition, then said 55 seconds later he never said it didn't affect competition. And then ultimately at the end, sort of the whole contradictory nature, basically the entire fraud that was perpetrated for the preceding 20 minutes by the Astros manager was pointed out by Marley Rivera of ESPN.
So how is it that it doesn't affect competition? So then what are you guys apologizing for?
We're apologizing because we broke the rules.
But isn't sign stealing a distinct advantage for the hitter, so doesn't it automatically impact competition?
It could possibly do that. It could possibly not.
Okay, guys, we're going to wrap up. Thank you, Dusty. Thank you, Jim.
Wow. The fact that they pull out so quickly after that makes me laugh very hard.
That's it. Thank you. We're done. It's all over.
Jim's dead, everybody. He died on this fateful day, February 13th, 2020.
Fatality.
Yes, time of death, 9 o'clock Central Time. Boy, that one's hard to get around. And, I mean, it's a great question. Why are they apologizing? What is the point of the apology if you're up there apologizing for something, but you don't think it had an impact on anything? Then you're clearly not that sorry, right?
Well, yeah, and that's kind of the question. What is the apology for? Apologies can serve different purposes. An apology can be about sort of you acknowledging a fault or something that you truly feel bad about. It can also be about getting someone else to not be mad at you. Hopefully those two things line up and that you're actually apologizing for the thing that made someone else mad, and that gives you the best shot at it. But in this case, I think the Astros felt compelled to apologize for two reasons. The first is they don't want to keep getting asked about it. Like, they really want to move on.
Yep.
Like, that's their organization would prefer to turn the page and not deal with it anymore. The second part is that they probably, as best they can, want to do damage control to minimize the antagonism that their players are going to face across the country, right? Like, that's the second part. They really don't care about AJ Hinch or Jeffrey Luna or Carlos Beltran or Alex Cora or all those guys that have moved on. They care about not having their achievements and accomplishments sort of minimized and their players being seen as, oh, George Springer's an all-star, but he stole signs. That would be what I would say their two goals are.
To be blunt, though, it's stupid to think that you're going to change anyone's reaction to your team when you show up in a ballpark by having an apology ceremony. What is this going to do for you? And that's what it was. And Danny, to your original point, this really feels like it's, all right, we want to get this over with. We want this to be over. We want this to be done. We want to move on. This is an idea that we have as far as how we can make that happen as quickly as possible. It's moronic. Like, this was going to change anything or affect anything. And now all it does is, with some of these players, you sort of self-incriminate. And on top of that, you just have an owner that gets pantsed by the media over a period of 30 minutes.
Is it possible he's an evil genius that just decided, like, he's made himself the story? Bob Knight did this. I'm convinced he did this about 30 years ago. They had a recruit named Damon Bailey who was going to be the best point guard ever. And when he was in eighth grade, Bob Knight was saying things like, Damon Bailey's better than any point guard we have on the team now. By the time Damon Bailey got there, he had been so built up that it was almost like the fact that he wasn't great. And he wasn't. He was a good player. He wasn't great. The fact that he wasn't great, Knight got more ripped on about it than Damon Bailey did. Damon Bailey was just a kid trying hard. Bob Knight was the one who was delusional. Like, is Crane making himself a buffoon to alleviate some of the pressure?
No, he put himself out there, and I think he thought he could explain this away. And I think a lot of people with money think that they can explain things away. And then they get put into these situations, and they realize, oh, yeah, I just have a lot of money, but when it actually comes to using my words to get around a situation like this, I'm hopelessly inadequate. And honestly, I think a lot of people also would have faltered in that situation. It was a no-win scenario. There was no reason for them to hold that. Because let's be honest, who amongst us, listening right now in your car, who was actually going to say, you know what, I forgive those Astros, man. They're just trying their hardest to win. No one is going to say that anywhere. No, and that's here. In New York, in Los Angeles, they're out for blood. I mean, some columnist in the LA Times compared what the Astros did to organized crime. And there are a lot of people that agree with that ridiculous sentiment. So, like,
well, you know what? You know what, Paul? It was organized and it was against the law.
True.
It was against the law of baseball. It was organized. I mean, they had a whole setup. There was a TV monitor there. There was a seat for a guy to sit there and just crush sunflower seeds. And there was a trash can to wail on to let everybody know.
And you have a guy who was compared to an organized crime boss in Carlos Beltran. You have a godfather or an El Jefe, whatever you want to call him, who's intimidating the players into committing these atrocities.
Now, that's the part of it where I don't buy.
You should.
I don't buy that there was some systematic, that this was foisted on the players. I don't think anybody stood up and said, you know what, you guys really shouldn't be doing this. Although it sounds like AJ Hinch was fairly resistant to the idea. But I don't think this was something that the players were like, well, I don't know about this. I think guys, this is how I think they justified it to themselves. Everybody's doing it. We know that other teams are doing it, and we're going to be behind if we don't do it, and we're in a window of opportunity to win a championship, and if we're certain that other guys are doing it, we're going to do it too, and it's not cheating if everybody's doing it. I think that's the justification they made, and it doesn't mean it was right, but they're unwilling to say that because it sounds bad, because it sounds like you're passing the buck, you're sounding like someone else. So instead, we get this charade of we're apologizing, but we're not fully apologizing.
Yep.
We're apologizing, but we're not fully. And the explanations that are being offered are trying to, like, let's see how we can preserve the most amount of dignity and respect possible while at least acknowledging that something was hinky here. Because that's pretty, it's pretty clear to everybody that something was not above board.
Yeah, 100%. But here we are. We're going to act as if there's people to blame, that they are gone, that this problem is done. That's the other question.
What would you have done if Jim Crane comes to you and says, what should I do?
Did I made mistakes?
No, just says, hey, Paul, how should I handle this? Because I think there's a sense of this that I'm not sure what the right answer is. I think the best way to deal with it would be to say, issue a blanket apology. Don't go into any of the specifics and say you're not going to answer any more questions and understand that the majority of the country is going to be furious at you.
Well, yeah, and I would if I were in charge of the Astros PR, I would have them release a statement where everyone you apologize. You don't say what you're specifically apologizing for so that you are not going to be held criminally liable for any of these lawsuits that are being thrown at them. And then after that, yeah, I don't answer any questions. And you know what? If some of these players want to apologize, I think that is the right, just because of the fact that they have not been punished at all. And they should honestly feel guilty that Jeff Luhnow and AJ Hinch are getting all of the blame for this, when it is very likely that this was pretty much mostly the players on this. And you know what? The punishment that they got was non-existent. They don't even get fined for what went down. I mean, even a fine would be something, I think, for the people that want the Astros players to get more punishment.
Why don't you think teams do that? Because by and large, people don't take that approach. Why wouldn't a team? It's clear they're not going to get in trouble. They didn't suffer any lasting damage as far as the organization. They lose a GM.
But they
lose
a good
manager.
One from the race.
Like, exactly. They might have gotten just as smart a GM. And honestly, with everything we know about Jeff Luhnow, like he seems to be pretty out of touch with decently treating people. Like, for all the different things, however smart he might be, like all of the different, how that organization handled one of their executives trying to intimidate and heckle female reporters about an accused domestic abuser that they acquired, like, shows that at the very least he doesn't know how to deal with people. Nothing's going to happen to him. Why don't they just say, like, okay, tough. You know what? Our World Series rings are still going to be displayed. We're proud of it. We know Houston loves us. Everybody else, you hate us because you ain't us. Why does no one do that?
I mean, teams have done that. No one on the New England Patriots,
outside
of Bill Belichick, who said he misinterpreted the rules, really apologized on that. And then the next season, I mean, they did go 18-0 in the wake of the Spygate scandal until they ultimately lost in Super Bowl 42 to the Giants. So there was no need for this apology to happen from the Astros front. They were not going to change anyone's minds. I understand why they felt that they needed to do it, but I think that going forward, this is sort of the reality of our culture in 2020. You do something, people just don't forgive you, and to hope that they will, you're really putting your faith in something that just does not really exist anymore, which is a forgiving, I can see your perspective on things kind of culture. And especially when it comes to cheating in a sport where outcomes and careers were adversely affected by said cheating.
How does the rest of the league, how does the rest of Major League Baseball react to this? That's the next step that we're going to take. That's coming up next on Danny and Gallant.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
I knew the signs, and I hit the baseball over 300 as a batting average as a result. Those are the lyrics of the new hit song,
Sweeping
America.
Either that or I saw the sign, then I hit the bat against the can.
Ooh. I need more trash can in that song right there.
Gotta have more trash can.
More trash can. I don't know why I'm making Christopher Walken sound the way that I'm making him sound. Danny, what do you think the first thing that happens to an Astros player this season will be? Do you think that the first pitch of the season, and I think some people are looking for this right now, punishment, retribution, vengeance, is throwing at Astros players' heads?
That's generally not how it works. When people are looking for it and anticipating it, that's not how baseball takes care of itself. There's a very clear code of things, and I do think there will be ways that teams act out. I do not believe that you're going to see the first pitch is high and tight and knocks a guy down. I don't, that's not how baseball does it. Baseball, there are purpose pitches, and they're usually at a spot where everybody in the game knows, but there's at least some plausible deniability. If the first Astros player that gets up there, George Springer's hitting leadoff, and he gets dusted, the guy's going to get suspended, and there's going to be no. It generally doesn't work that way. I think the question of whether more guys will get hit by pitches is a valid one. I don't know the answer to it.
That's necessarily the punishment that is going to make anyone feel any better about what went down. And you might feel in a moment that, hey, I got the better of him, but here's the reality. You're putting one of these guys on base, and you're making it a little bit easier for them to steal signs the old-fashioned way, ironically. I think there will be maybe less paranoia given what has happened and the punishments that have been handed down. I don't think, and I'm hoping that this is the case, because it has definitely led to, I think, games becoming longer, the kind of paranoia about sign stealing that there's been in years past, but maybe it continues. And honestly, you got to give the Washington Nationals a lot of credit. From these articles that we have seen released over the last couple of days, the Washington Post, the Athletic, about what happened in the World Series, basically, the Nationals, they gave each pitcher five sets of signs, which were inside their caps, and they gave their catchers wristbands like they were quarterbacks. So they were always putting down multiple signs. And we saw it, I think, was it Game 7 where Strasburg had a really rough first inning, but afterwards he settled down. And maybe they thought that they had stolen the signs at that point. And then as the rest of the game progressed, they didn't know what to do because they thought that they had had the signs down pat, and ultimately whatever they had stolen didn't really do anything for them. So I'm wondering if there's less paranoia or more paranoia on the front of how do we guard from people potentially stealing those signs of ours.
Yeah, I think we're eventually going to go to a spot where you can, they're going to have direct radio communication. That would be my bet, that you're going to have an earpiece and guys are going to talk into their gloves and they're just going to eliminate that part of it. I don't know how, if you're getting a live video feed, do you even need to see the sign? Can you start seeing how somebody, it's a different way to pick up tells. I'm not really sure. I do know that the Astros have not done themselves any favors by how they've talked about or the level of accountability they have or haven't taken. That's certainly not endeared any sort of, it seems like they were widely viewed and seen antagonistically around the league, and that is, look, only going to be compounded by what we saw today.
If they were less arrogant, I wonder what happens. I wonder if there is such a unanimous, I think, coming together on trying to bring them down. But it is funny. This was a secret that was widely known across baseball, and Mike Fiers is the guy who brings it down.
Here's the part about that, and this came out. Bob Melvin, the A's manager, he said yesterday that they formally complained to baseball. Like, that they formally said, this is what's happening. And that was before Fiers ever said anything. If I was looking at it from the health of the game standpoint, the biggest problem here isn't necessarily that the sign stealing was occurring. It's that baseball was told it was occurring and was absolutely incompetent in stopping it, to the point where if I was a player right now, and there was something that I thought a team was doing illegally or against the rules, I would not complain about it to the league. I'd tell a reporter. Like, that's great for our business, and that's great for reporters. That's a terrible thing. That's a terrible thing for a business to have. Like, just looking at it from business, to be unable to deal with anything in-house to the point where guys get so frustrated that say the only way it's going to change is if I shame them into it.
Or smash a television like I'm AJ Hinch, or if I speak up in opposition to it like Brian McCann supposedly did. But those are the only measures that it seems like were taken by the Astros to stop any of this. They're all going to have their own spin on how they saw it in 2017, 2 years ago, as opposed to how they see it now. That's how I think all of us are. We all have a bit of revisionist history, I think, when it comes to accountability.
There was a press release, right, that Major League Baseball sent out that basically said, stop doing this. And it was basically saying that stop stealing signs. There's a memo or whatever you want to call it that went around to all of the teams that said stop doing this.
Yep.
And it's what it sounds like is that's the parent. You're like, okay, fine, yeah, whatever. Say what you want. We're gonna keep doing whatever we want to do. And we don't believe you have the teeth to be able to. And at that point, you're kind of the question. I don't question the commissioner himself. I question the commissioner's office. How much power do you really have?
He doesn't have a lot. And I also wonder, too, if those other teams actually stopped in doing what they had been doing. I mean, the Astros definitely did it to a much, from what we're hearing, the Astros did it to a much more extreme degree than any other team. Like, they added the trash can banging in there. But did these teams,
are we sure about that? The Red Sox got in trouble for Apple Watches, right?
Yes.
The Astros, I guess, we're not, that have been shamed. I'm not certain that theirs was more complicated or worse. They won more, and maybe they were the epicenter of it because it seems like the different guys that have gotten in trouble have spiraled out from that. But that might just be because this is the one we know about, that they had the snitches. That it wasn't, the problem wasn't that they were worse cheaters. It's that they brought in guys who rolled quicker. They had a bunch of squealers.
Ultimately, is this something that is good for baseball that this got uncovered and that there's also uncertainty about other teams maybe having done this? Or would this be better as something that is overlooked and that baseball just sort of just shrugs its shoulders collectively at? Because honestly, they did that with the steroid era. And for those people who enjoyed the steroid era, like myself, I thought that was a fantastic time to watch baseball. There was power and there was it just was, I thought, a fantastic game in the late 90s and the early 2000s. I think the shrugging of your shoulders at that and just being able to look back on that time and enjoy it, that would have been a good thing for baseball. Instead, there's a lot of people that look back on it and they're like, oh, what a shameful time for the sport. Understandably, because there were some players who were getting an edge and other players were doing it the right way, and their careers didn't exactly go probably the way that they would have wanted.
Isn't that because the press that covers baseball is weird, though? Like, honestly, isn't
very territorial.
It's not territorial. They treat baseball like a religion as opposed to a game. Like, it's treated as a part of, it's the national pastime, like George Carlin used to joke. There's this entire thing that you betrayed the game. People have used steroids in all sorts of sports. And you don't see, except the Tour de France, where they actually have police officers that raid different things before the competition. Like, you don't see people talking about, oh my God, the 80s and the NFL were this horrific era. Like, nobody else has the crisis of conscience that baseball reporters seem to have about something that happened.
But the records, man.
Yeah, and I get that. I get that records are important, and I understand. I just don't understand why it is considered as if it's a betrayal. And in other sports, it's considered like, well, that's something we have to account for.
You're 100% right, and to put it simply, baseball is a sport where cheating is practically encouraged. And yet, here we are, making the biggest deal about cheating scandals in baseball yet again. It's funny to me.
It is funny. Well, there's a trash can being banged.
That's the funniest part. It's Danny and Gallant. He's Danny O'Neill. I am Paul Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle. Jim Crane just completely puked all over himself with his apology today. How does his apology compare to some of the other, well, let's just say rough apologies over the history of sports? We will discuss that next. Don't go anywhere.